Alaska's oil and gas sector has long been in decline, from a peak of oil production in the 80s of more than 2 million barrels per day to a 75% drop to under 500,000 today. With some projects in development now and a new extraction-friendly administration coming into the White House, will Alaska's fossil fuel sector boom again? Or will the world's move towards renewables change industry development plans here? We'll discuss the future of Alaska's energy industry today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Willow, Pika, there are new oil projects coming online that the industry says will add 260,000 barrels of oil per day to the pipeline within the next few years. Are other projects being considered? If the federal government opens up more of the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge or the NPRA, will developers be interested in ANWR or NPRA? Does Ukraine shutting off Russia's gas line to Europe make an Alaska gas line more feasible? And what about the renewable energy economy in Alaska? The state's population has also declined and the booming extraction industry economy that was hit so hard during the pandemic has recovered, but not fully. What's the future picture for energy production here? We've got two longtime Alaska industry observers on the line with us today. Tim Bradner has been reporting on Alaska's oil and gas industry and state government for decades. Tim is the publisher and editor of the Alaska Economic Report and the Alaska Legislative Digest. And Lois Epstein is here. Lois on the line with us. Lois is an engineer and the president of LNE Engineering and Policy. And also joining us from Washington State is Scott L. Montgomery. Scott is with the University of Washington in Seattle at the Jackson School of International Studies with the Earth and Science Department. He is a former petroleum engineer and has been teaching for 20 years. Welcome, all of you. Okay, so I had planned to start with some historical overview of the oil and gas industry in Alaska, and yesterday's announcement reminded me both of the potential for the future, but also how long it's been bandied about, the Alaska Gas Line. Here's what Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation President Frank Richards said during a press conference with Governor Mike Dunleavy about efforts to build a more than $40 billion natural gas line from the North Slope to Nikiski.
Today, after 10 years of planning, engineering, and permitting, I'm announcing that AGDC has reached an exclusive framework agreement with a qualified energy company to privately lead and fund the development of the Alaska LNG project.
The first time I heard about a firm deal for an Alaska gas line was when Frank Murkowski was governor, and he held up some documents at a press conference and said something along the lines of, "I have in my hand the agreement to build a gas line." That was in 2006, and the price tag was $20 billion, half of what it is today. Even NPR reported on that agreement. Governor Dunleavy said at yesterday's press event that he thinks there's a, quote, real opportunity for the project.
I've questioned it for years, to be perfectly honest with you. And I, as I mentioned earlier, I've been hesitant to talk about it until there's some real concrete, steps going forward. But I think we're entering a phase of reality for this pipeline.
Richards says he expects to announce a final agreement within the next few months. So, Tim, you've been following this longer than I have. Does yesterday's announcement sound more certain than past announcements about this project? The governor called it a phase of reality. How do you see it?
Lori, we all have a sense we've heard all this before. I mean, you mentioned Governor Murkowski in 2005 with the North Slope producers. And I remember Governor Walker going to China with a deal with the Chinese government, and things looked pretty good. And then relations between the U.S. and China went bad. I don't know. There's a sense of deja vu here. On the other hand, there's a lot of skepticism about this project. But still, you know, my sense is, well, let it play out. Give it a chance. Let's see what happens. Maybe there will be something. Personally, I think until a new company can come in and do the engineering and the cost, a new cost estimate, but until you see the Japanese and Koreans sign long-term take-or-pay gas LNG purchase contracts from Alaska, I don't think you're going to see much happen, because that's what we need for anybody to finance this project.
We need the buyers locked in.
Right, and we don't have that yet.
Lois, your thoughts here. Are there ways the new Trump administration can actually speed up oil and gas development in Alaska?
Well, that's first of all, thank you, Lori, for doing this show and having me on and the others. As Tim said, we've seen this before, a little bit of deja vu here. The administration that is incoming has tried in the past to move forward with various different things in Alaska. And we even heard a little bit of that in the press conference today that President-elect Trump had. But what's happened is there is so many reasons that Alaska hasn't been developed on federal lands to date. There are laws that must be complied with. There's environmental and attorneys, tribal attorneys that have made very strong arguments about why it doesn't make sense and it doesn't comply with various different laws. And when you switch back and forth between administrations, you're going to have uncertainty in the business environment. And as we all know, as Alaskans, it takes many years to put a project in place, not just one administration. So I think what we are likely to see is not a different path than we've been on, where Willa's going to be developed, Nuna project on state lands is going to be moving forward, Pikka as well. State lands are where most of the development has happened in the past, and it's a lot less controversial. So I don't see giant changes. There may be rhetorical changes, but not changes on the ground.
All right. Thank you, Lois. And I want to, later on in the program, I want to drill down a bit on this idea about uncertainty for investment and what that means. But Scott, moving to you, with a president who wants to expand resource development and Republicans controlling the House and Senate, what do you think will happen in the next year or two related to efforts to spur production and reduce restrictions?
I do believe that Mr. Trump will move to open up more federal lands to leasing, and he will try to open up portions of the offshore as well. I'm not sure the industry is that interested in the offshore, except in the Gulf Coast to the northeast, where there is significant potential. And everyone knows that, but it's been off limits for a while. In terms of Alaska, I think Lois was saying what we all perceive, that the companies are going to be a little bit less interested in federal land, except unless the potential is extremely high. And for the exact reason that she said, that it's much more vulnerable to political winds. The potential along the North Slope from Kuparuk River all the way to Smith Bay is very large. It may not be continuous, but it is very large. And so it does go across state lands into federal lands. But there's a great deal of uncertainty, as she said.
And Scott, what are your thoughts about this announcement yesterday of the pipeline? What are you thinking about the viability of this project at this time?
Yeah, well, you know, funding for it, support for it is all important. And one of the reasons is that its main competitor are not other countries, but the Gulf Coast LNG export terminals. They are coming on very strong in the next couple of years. They may increase the ability of the U.S. to export by 20 to 25, even 30%. And so the overall need seen from the point of view of Asia, which is the center of LNG demand, which is growing very rapidly, I should say. So there should be room for Alaska. Nonetheless, it does have this large competition from shale and tight gas in the lower 48 and these new export facilities coming online. Mm-hmm. So it's very uncertain. And I would agree with both Lois and Tim that funding is very, very important. If you can get contracts from, Taiwan too, is another option. But Japan, South Korea, possibly China, we'll see. That would be very, very important. So, mm-hmm.
All right. So still a lot to be determined there, and we'll just have to watch and see what kind of unfolds. So moving on from the gas line for a bit. Tim, an Anwar lease sale will happen on the 10th, and I think I mistakenly said earlier that Anwar is the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. Of course, that's not correct. It is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A lease sale will happen on the 10th. What do you expect to come from it? What level of interest do you think there will or won't be this time?
Well, Lori, I mean, there always could be a wild card in there, but just at this point, I'd have to predict that the response will be about what it was last time, rather modest. And in this case, we might not be surprised if there are no significant bids from companies, because the area, this lease sale was developed by the Biden administration, and the area being offered is smaller. You could argue it's got some prospects, but the lease terms and the restrictions are very restrictive, and a company looking at that may decide that this is just not worth messing around with. That's besides the kind of toxic political environment that they're going to be wading into. So I kind of predicted it's going to be about the same as the 2001 sale. I would not be surprised if there were no industry bidders. The question is the state of Alaska through the Alaska Industrial Development Authority going to submit new bids? And a twist to that is the fact that ADA bid in the last lease sale and picked up a lot of the same acreage that's being offered again. Mm-hmm. So they have a lawsuit. It's going to tangle this thing up in legal affairs. They have a lawsuit pending with the Department of Interior that those previous leases are still valid. So how they're going to bid again on leases that they previously owned, it's going to be really interesting to see how it turns out.
Yes, really interesting. Some fascinating things going on there. And you mentioned the restrictions on this sale that will happen on the 10th, Tim. Is it possible that those restrictions that were added, could the new administration remove those, or would that take some separate type of action down the road?
Well, Lori, I'm not a lawyer. Scott might and Lois might have a view on this, but my sense is that they could, but it'll take time. You may have to have another lease sale, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's a reauthorization of the Tax Act that Senator Murkowski will put a requirement for another lease sale in there, in which the lease terms might be different. But it might be difficult, not impossible, but time-consuming to go back and undo the restrictions on these leases. Lois, do you have any thoughts, Lois?
Yes,
or
Lois.
Scott?
I would add that one thing that is very different is the environmental impact statement that was developed under the Biden administration. There's a lot of very solid science in there that wasn't in place before the Trump administration environmental impact statement was rushed in a sense. It needed to be finished by the end of the term to the previous Trump administration. So this is very different. The details in that supplemental EIS that was recently issued are very important. They include protections for caribou, for cultural resources, for permafrost. So what we're calling limitations are actually very meaningful measures that are in place. The acreage that's being offered is in compliance with what the Tax Act allowed. It's at a minimum of 400,000 acres, and that's what is being offered. So while there have been some statements made that the lease sale is, you know, too limited in scope, the protections that are in there are very important and very meaningful and very solid. I think the new administration will have a tough time overturning those.
All right. Any comments there, Scott, that you want to follow up on, or Tim, are you trying to get
back? Yeah, a couple of things. I think if you'll allow me to enter the minds or the rationality of industry workers, but also the Trump administration, the best policy for them would be to cancel the lease sale now and to reform it and rehold it, or maybe just hold the one now in a pro forma way and then reconceive it and offer it in a year or maybe two. I don't think they'll do that. They would think about reoffering different parcels and everything. But from the discussion, it's clear that that any ANWR lease sale is going to be political. And the current restrictions are, you know, bear that out. A company would see those as hurdles for sure. They're very restrictive for a federal lease sale as a whole, on the whole. So I would agree with Tim in terms of any forecasting. I don't think any companies will be seriously interested. I would say there remain a lot of questions about whether ANWR is oil rich or gas rich. And that would make a very big difference from a company's point of view. There is infrastructure now because of the Port Thompson field that goes right up to the edge of ANWR, and that solved a long-standing problem. But it's not in ANWR, and it's not as close to the parcels that are offered, so that it would be cheap to build new infrastructure to any discoveries. I'm just very uncertain about it, and I think that it'll remain pretty much off limits in the industry's mind. Too much success to the West, frankly.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're discussing Alaska's energy future with a new administration coming into the White House. My guests on the line today are Tim Bradner. Tim is the publisher of the Alaska Economic Report and the Alaska Legislative Digest, and Tim has reported on the oil and gas industry in Alaska for decades. Lois Epstein is an engineer and president of LNE Engineering and Policy here in Alaska, and Scott L. Montgomery is faculty at the University of Washington in Seattle at the Jackson School of International Studies. And Lois, I want to go back to you for a moment here. Describe the work that you do on behalf of tribes and conservation organizations as it relates to projects like ANWR and the proposed road to the Ambler Mining District, or what people would like, some developers would like to see as a mining district in that Ambler area.
What happens when projects affect federal land is that they're nearly always will be some sort of environmental impact statement. Sometimes if there's less impact, there would be an environmental assessment. But those documents are very comprehensive as to all the impacts, both to the air, the water, the land, but also on the people that would be affected. Many times in Alaska, of course, that involves tribes. Along with other subject matter experts, I am someone that works for tribes and conservation organizations to look at specific aspects of those impacts and comment on them and provide that to the federal government, which then will have their own experts. The state will also weigh in, of course, and they will make some decisions based on all that information about whether projects either should go forward, should be changed, et cetera. So what you have is, I would argue, the Biden administration took good science very seriously. They looked at and heard from tribes about their cultural resources and how best to protect them. And they took their responsibilities as federal landowners seriously as well. We talk about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, sometimes calling it ANWR, which is very generic a term, but it is Fish and Wildlife Service land. There are laws that are in place that say what it means for those lands and what needs to be done to protect, of course, the fish and wildlife and other aspects of that land in Northeast Alaska.
And Lewis,
can I add just one more thing? Sorry. The coastal plain, which is where the part of the Arctic refuge where oil development is being considered, is the very, very important habitat for the porcupine caribou herd that calves and raises those calves the weeks after their birth. It's the best habitat possible. And that caribou, and I've worked closely with caribou scientists in the past few years, is considered essentially a sacred resource for many, many tribes in that area, both in the U.S. and Canada.
And as an engineer, Lois, you wrote comments on the environmental impact statement, the EIS, on ANWR and the NPRA. You noted that the Trump administration narrowed protections in the NPRA, the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, that former President Obama had put in place. What changed, and why can a president change those types of protections but not reverse things like the Northern Bering Sea protection?
It's a good question. And a complicated one. So some things need changes in laws in order to be altered, and some things can be done what we call administratively by the new administration. And even within that, there are complications because some things require regulatory changes, which are a much longer process than the things that can be done by executive order. So there's no quick and easy answer about what the new administration can do just on the first day or over the four-year period. The details matter, and it all has to be in compliance with the federal laws, of course. And many people from all kinds of perspectives are looking at that.
All right. Thank you. So, Scott, turning back to you for a moment before we have to take a break here at the bottom of the hour, you characterized in an earlier interview the current state of oil and gas industry here as uncertain. Talk a little bit about what you meant.
Okay. This has to do with sort of the larger, the global context for oil and gas. The situation right now for oil in particular, since that's a more valuable fuel from the point of view of the producers, is that global demand is very uncertain going forward. That has a great deal to do with China's situation, its economic situation, its increase in its electric vehicle fleet. China is now more than 50% new car sales are EVs, are plug-in hybrids, and it looks as if that's going to continue, but that will have a great deal to do with the economy. Now, China is attempting to stimulate its economy, and its demand on for oil actually went up slightly. It's been going down during 2024. The reason I focus on China is that the Chinese have been driving increases in global oil demand for almost a decade now, and we're talking about global oil demand. There is a chance that other countries could make up the difference. India in particular, but a number of emerging economies such as Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Turkey. But there is also new oil coming on the market. Brazil, Guyana, particularly in northeast of South America. Whether the U.S. will increase its oil production has a great deal to do with price at this point. It's reached a historic peak and has decreased slightly from that. The supply from Russia is very uncertain. Russia is delivering a great deal of oil. The majority of its exports are seaborne and delivering them from what is called a dark tanker fleet.
And I do want to talk about that after we take a break, but I don't want to launch into that discussion quite yet because I do want to get you and Tim's thoughts on that and Lois as well about that that concern with Russian oil. But before we do take that break, Tim, you noted in an earlier interview that in the early days of oil discovery and development, the industry involved was large, big industry players, BP, ConocoPhillips, Exxon. That's changed over time to smaller operators. What does that mean for development in the future here? How do things change when these folks are such different players?
Well, Lori, in the beginning, basically BP did the early work leading up to the geology and the exploration of the slope, and it was followed quickly by ARCO and Humboldt. These are large companies with deep pockets. Many dry holes were drilled up to the discovery of Prudhoe Bay, so there was a lot of investment. And some of the BP, for example, almost left the North Slope because of their disappointing results. But then Exxon enters it. These are companies that are large. They could afford to build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, build the infrastructure for the North Slope. But over time, things changed. The production starts declining. Frankly, the prospects on the North Slope were for fairly good for medium-sized fields, certainly small deposits, not the big giant fields that companies like BP and Exxon are really looking for. So gradually, over time, their interest began to be distracted, looking elsewhere, and less interested in the North Slope. And so, you know, we're seeing BP is no longer with us. It sold its interest to Hilcorp, a major independent. ConocoPhillips is still there, legacy ARCO operation. Exxon's still there, but only as a producer. Exxon is not exploring. BP was not exploring. Conoco is still exploring, to their credit, good for Alaska. Mm. But mainly we've got major independents coming in, as well as a number of small companies. But from almost an environmental protection point of view, we want companies that have deep pockets in case there's an accident. They have to do a major cleanup. So we don't want small companies that have thin resources.
An excellent point. We do need to take a quick break, and we will continue our discussion about the future of Alaska's energy industry. And after the break, we'll get to some discussion about the late President Jimmy Carter's impact on Alaska when he signed the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA. We'll have more discussion on this as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing Alaska's energy future with a new administration coming into the White House. On the line with us today is Tim Bradner. Tim is the publisher of the Alaska Economic Report and the Alaska Legislative Digest. Tim has reported on the oil and gas industry for decades in Alaska. Lois Epstein is an engineer and president of LNE Engineering and Policy. And Scott L. Montgomery is faculty at the University of Washington in Seattle at the Jackson School of International Studies. So just let's quickly talk a bit more about the changing dynamic in the players in the industry, and then we'll move on to Russian oil and ANILCA before we wrap up today. Tim, the large industry companies that were involved in the state in the past donated lots of money for various public interest projects. Do you see this level of engagement with the smaller companies? You were mentioning that they don't have the deep pockets that those larger companies have.
Well, deep pockets is kind of a relative term. A company like Hillcorp, for example, which is now a major operator and producer of the North Slope, has pretty deep pockets. It's a privately owned company, one individual, but still, it doesn't operate on the scale that BP did. They have a different profile, for example, in their public contribution mix, the way they do it. Conoco is very active in community affairs, like the major companies were, but besides them, you've got, and of course, Exxon is still here and is still active in the community, but a number of small explorers. And the way this works is explorers will come in, drill wells, hope to find discoveries, and then usually they bring in, larger companies as partners. And we saw that very clearly with a entrepreneur, geologist, explorer, Bill Armstrong of Denver, very aggressively exploring with his own nickel on the North Slope with some partners, making finds, selling them to other companies. And now we have Repsol here as a result of Bill Armstrong and the Pekka, Australian-based company Santos came in. So that seems to be the way things will work. Mm-hmm. By the way, Armstrong is also exploring now very aggressive program east of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Apache in as a partner. So it'd be very interesting to see how that turns out.
All right. Well, thank you. And Lois, we know that, as Tim was just talking about Hillcorp and their operations, and you've raised concerns about Hillcorp, the number of fines they've had to pay, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission oversight of their work. What are your current concerns, and what kind of a grade do you give Hillcorp for their work in Alaska?
Well, I think the fines by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission speak for themselves. They've been substantial and large, and sadly, there have been injuries and deaths associated with Hillcorp's work. I think another thing that's going on with the upcoming legislative session is looking a little bit more closely at how much or how little Hillcorp benefits the state financially, because they are a private company. They don't pay the same level of taxes as public oil and gas operations, and that's a separate concern.
All right, Scott, I want to turn to you. You had mentioned earlier in a previous interview the technology advances with fracking, the process of breaking up shale rock, extracting oil and gas. Talk about these advances, and do you see that maybe that technology could be used to revitalize older fields that could maybe help Cook Inlet gas supplies?
Yes, it certainly could. And it could. It's being used in some of the North Slope, the newer fields. I wanted to add just a little bit to what Tim said about the big companies versus the independents, the private independents. It's actually a pattern in the industry that these more risk-taking smaller companies will come in and develop a frontier in an area that has a fair bit of information already, a good knowledge base and some infrastructure. So this is a pattern that's happened in the lower 48 as well. The quality of the data that exists today is much higher than when I was an explorationist in the industry in the 1980s and the 90s. And so the rate of success is much higher. And for these companies that are smaller and that are willing to take the risk, the frontier risk, they have a significant chance. We might recall, and this will be a segue to your question, if you'll permit me, that the fracking revolution, and it really has been a revolution, was really pioneered by small independent companies, not the big majors. Big majors let go a lot of their research geologists in the early 90s when the prices were very low. And a lot of those excellent scientists, some of whom I was in graduate school with, were important in developing the fracking technology and in continuing to advance it. So this is not something that just was matured and then stopped. It is continuing to advance so that fewer wells now have to be drilled to produce the same amount of oil or gas. There are many fields that can be revitalized by this technology, and there are many shale formations that can be further developed or begun to be developed. And one of them is the Hugh Shale, which is a major source rock in the Colville River Basin, which is where most of the production in the North Slope in the U.S. Takes place. So the fracking technology and the horizontal drilling, they both go together. And there are a few other technologies as well, measurement while drilling. They are continuing to advance and continuing to lower costs for drilling. And this is very important for extreme, what are called extreme areas like the Arctic because of its climate challenges. And so cheaper wells and moderate pricing make the North Slope more attractive. And this applies to other areas of the world as well. Alaska is I would say, if I can just speak a little bit more, is poised to go back above 500,000 barrels a day, I would say, maybe even to 600,000 to 700,000 barrels a day. It depends on how far these new plays are extended. I would say it has not finished in terms of new field discoveries and production. Alaska is sort of setting a pace for the Arctic as a whole. These companies have the most advanced technology and exploration capabilities. They are far more advanced than what is happening in Russia.
So we do have some potential for, as you said, revitalization, new technology, yes. Fracking that could bring new energy to some of these declining fields in Prudhoe Bay. Before we take another break, I wanted to quickly just talk for a moment about Tim and Scott. You both raised Russia's shipping of oil and decommissioned tankers. And I've read about this also, reporting on Russia sneaking oil shipments in junky tankers to continue selling oil through illegal means. Talk about what you've read about this concerned him, especially when we have a sort of a new Cold War with Russia. Alaska Search and Rescue and scientists are not working with their Russian counterparts, and a spill in the Arctic could be really difficult to address. Tim, what are your thoughts?
Well, Lori, we've all heard a lot about the Northern Sea Route across Russia. It's getting pretty busy. Russia is sending a lot of encouraging marine transit. All of their LNG from their new Arctic deposits are coming west. And every time you hear about a shipment of Arctic Russian oil to Asia, it's all coming through the Bering Strait. And the fact is, we don't know much about what's the number of ships, what's in those ships, the condition of those ships, whether they have insurance. Mostly they stay on the Russia side of the Bering Strait. So that's, they're not violating international law. But we have no agreements with Russia now on oil spill, contingency planning. I would hate to think what happened if there was a problem out there. And what concerns me is we just haven't heard anything about this. The U.S. Coast Guard is, I'm sure, very much on top of what the Russians are doing and what they're shipping through, but they don't like to talk about it.
And Scott, you said that that there's maybe 500 tankers a month, a fifth of the world tanker fleet. Where is this information coming from, and how could it be verified when Russia is trying to hide these shipments?
Those are estimates for sure, but just the volume of the seaborne oil that is going to China and India, just those two countries, testifies to a very large fleet of tankers delivering them. I would say, if I may, they are actually transgressing international law. Some of these are falsifying their locations. They are turning off their transponders to hide their location. They are sending out, as I said, false information. This is all fairly illegal. Some of them have very questionable insurance. One of them now is in quarantine because of being accused of clipping or cutting communications cables in the Baltic Sea. Russia actually has a significant export terminal in the Baltic, connection with the Baltic Sea, and so it's been shipping a fair bit through that. Its pipeline system, which is the largest in the world, trends to very heavily to the west, to Europe. It's a major concern, and some of the people who are involved in the International Marine Organization are saying that it has to be sanctioned, and the sanctions have to be enforced. And if that does happen in the next year, that will cut back on Russia's oil supply. And that could significantly increase prices. We'll have to see what happens.
All right. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about Alaska's energy future as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing Alaska's energy future. So, Lois, I want to give you a chance here to comment on this concern over Russia's tankers taking secret deliveries or sending out secret deliveries of oil. And because you work with conservation organizations and tribes, what are you hearing about this concern for coastal communities of the potential for a spill in the Arctic that has very little infrastructure for these things and a frosty relationship with our Russian counterparts?
Yeah, of course, there's tremendous concern about anything that would affect the Bering Sea coastline, Western Alaska. The resources there from a subsistence standpoint are critical. So I have been hearing that, and the increased numbers of tankers and other shipping in there have got to be worrisome to people who live there. I did want to add a little bit of information to Scott's points about the fracking revolution and how that might affect Alaska. One of the important things to remember is that drilling in Alaska is not only on federal lands, but much more frequently it's on state lands, and fracking may occur there, as I mentioned earlier, much less controversial than the federal lands. But also connected to the bigger topic of this discussion, the likely head of the Department of Interior, Doug Burgum, is currently the governor of North Dakota.
Yes.
Fracking has been huge there, as it has in West Texas and in New Mexico, all state lands, not federal lands, for the most part. So he's very familiar with the potential for oil development how fracking it has had an impact on his state. And on the tribes in the state. They generally, from what I've seen, he's had a good relationship with at least some of the tribes in North Dakota. And, you know, that's going to be important in terms of how he makes decisions in Alaska as well.
All right, let's go to the phones for a moment. Karen is in somewhere in Southeast. Hello, Karen.
Good morning.
Did you have a question?
I had a question on fracking, and I was trying to remember because there was, to me, there was so much negative about it for my thought, but I had to go back and try to remember, you know, with fracking, have we looked at the environment where we're going to be doing this? That what areas are we looking at? I just happen to come in at the tail end.
I see. We were talking in general terms about the advancements in the technology and how it might be used to revitalize older fields.
So, thinking generating more oil in older fields?
Yes, it's got that potential. Thank you for the call, Karen. I want to get back to our guests here because we only have a couple of minutes left. And I wanted to get to the fact that, Lois, the late President Jimmy Carter's funeral services are taking place this week in the nation's capital. Carter signed the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, into law. How much protection does this legislation offer if there are areas of extraction of interest within those lands or waters?
Well, for those who don't know, ANILCA has had a tremendous impact on Alaska because it basically set aside areas that would be national parks, national wildlife refuges, and a Bureau of Land Management lands. They each have different levels of protection. And of course, Alaska, its identity, its tourism industry has all been greatly changed as a result of ANILCA, which was, excuse me, signed by Jimmy Carter in 1980. Originally, there was a lot of concern about ANILCA in Alaska, and there's been a lot written about it. I would refer people to Tom Kazaya's article in the Anchorage Daily News that came out a week or two ago. But that's changed. Many communities have absolutely benefited from the hunting, fishing, tourism revenues that have come as a result of ANILCA. Having said that, and relating it to this discussion, those lands that were set aside for good reasons, the ecological, special ecologically important places, places that are globally significant, that have Alaska is now well known for, including the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Those areas are also often incredibly important for subsistence reasons for the tribes that utilize those areas to practice their traditions and way of life, as well as use it for food resources. So, depending on the different areas that were set aside and what jurisdiction there is, there's going to be different rules about whether you can drill in them. National parks, of course, do not have oil and gas drilling. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, coastal plain, that's what we've been talking about throughout the show, about whether there should be development or not, and if so, what those restrictions would be. I could go on and on, but I know we're short of time.
Yeah, we only have a couple of minutes left. And I did want to get to a question. So, Lois, I'm going to stick with you for a minute here. Do you think you are engaged in policy, and do you think there's a path to creating more settled policy so that investors can feel confident that if they put up a ton of money, things won't get tossed out the policy window when a new president takes office? Because we see a lot of this back and forth. Is there a way to depoliticize these decisions to avoid putting investors off their feet, or is that just the way that it works?
Well, if you asked many of my colleagues, they would say we've got to move off of oil and gas and fossil fuels and move forward with renewables as fast as we can. That's the one sure way to provide business certainty over the long run, to ensure consumers don't have to worry about the cost of gasoline going up and down. And I can, if we look at the Alaska Arctic offshore, the industry has pulled out. It's too risky, too expensive. Alaska's always going to be an expensive place to operate. So while we've had this back and forth in the past and likely we'll have it in the future, over the long run, I think Alaska's going to be, with the exception of the state lands, of course, you know, we're not going to continue to grow as an oil province with some smaller exceptions. But over the long run, you know, we need to think of other our economy in a more diverse, more comprehensive way. And one thing that I think Alaskans don't really recognize is that right now, only 18% of the state budget overall is coming from petroleum. I just looked at the most recent fall revenue forecast that came out. And, you know, so we're on the downward slope. So oil and drilling is not going to save the state.
All right. We have about a minute left here. And Tim, kind of picking up on that investment question and future certainty, incoming President-elect Trump has said he wants to cancel renewable projects and lean into oil and gas development. How does that kind of uncertainty about the direction of this industry, renewable or not, affect investment plans and where companies would want to aim next?
Lori, I think there's just so much momentum already on renewables that I don't think it's really going to have much of a near-term impact. It might have some. I mean, it'll change sort of the public rhetoric, but boy, there's just such a fast pace of development of renewables that they're getting so inexpensive. The economics are really what's going to drive this, and when it's cheaper to do a wind farm or a solar farm in Alaska that you can deliver power for the same price as you can deliver it for generating with natural gas, that's really interesting. And I don't think the new president's going to change that. Hey, Lori, if we have a minute, I'd like to make a comment on something earlier we spoke to. We
got about 20 seconds or so.
Okay. Hilcorp, maybe a certain amount to criticize, but they have an excellent operational record of resurrecting old oil and gas fields and bringing on new production. And that happened in Cook Inlet when they took over, restoring gas, and it's happening on the North Slope now. Prudhoe Bay is flat production. It should have declined a lot longer, substantially. And Hilcorp's very energetic operator
brought new energy to those fields. All right, thank you. I did want to get to an email comment from Hannah saying, my husband and I are young professionals in Alaska. He grew up here. We love it, would like to start a family, but fear the state's mismanagement and failure to move away from an oil and gas economy will force us to move away. I want to say thanks to our guests, Tim Bradner, Lois Epstein, and Scott L. Montgomery. And thanks to the team that helped us get this show done today, our engineer, Chris Hyde. Our producer was Wesley Early today, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.